Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use. Hello, ladies. Hello, gentlemen. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I'm Jack Fowler, the host. We are recording sometime in late August. This is one of several episodes that will be airing while Victor is teaching at Hillsdale College. Speaking of Hillsdale, Victor is the, well, let me, I got to get this in the order. I always do it, Victor. I'll confuse myself. Victor Davis Hanson is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. I'm pretty sure this podcast is going to be airing, I think, August 30th. Anyway, while you're listening, Victor will be at Hillsdale teaching, grading. I hope you're not going to be failing anyone, Victor. These series of podcasts are based on questions that our listeners have sent in. We got hundreds of questions. And difficult to pick and choose, but hey, we've got plenty, and we're going to have some eclectic collection here on this first episode. But before we get to those questions, there is just one matter of interest that Victor is going to be talking about, and that's craziness at the American Historical Association. And we're going to get his views on that and then get to some listener questions right after these important messages.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I'm Jack Fowler. Hey, quickly about me. I write Civil Thoughts, a weekly free email newsletter. You'll enjoy it. No strings attached, no cost, no risk. It's produced by the Center for Civil Society at American Philanthropic. That's where I hang my hat. Sign up for it. CivilThoughts.com. Also, visit VictorHanson.com. That's where all of Victor's works are. And much of those works are exclusive content. You can't read them unless you subscribe. $5. That's it. $5. That's less than a gallon of gasoline, right, Victor?
Well,
depending on where you are.
Depends on whether you live in California or not.
Right. So, $50 for a year. You will regret not having done it sooner. VictorHanson.com. So, Victor, before we get to some of the questions,
I sent you, and I was kind of not shocked, but disappointed, depressed. The suicide of the American Historical Association. This is a piece written by Philip Magnus for the American Institute for Economic Research.
Yes.
And in a nutshell, the president of the association, James H. Sweet, who I guess wasn't an absolute lefty, he mildly criticized what he called presentism in history, like we are taking the views of 2022 and implanting them on 1619, 1776. For all I know, it's 44 BC, the same. And of course, when he wrote this and it was a published column in the organization's magazine, and the onslaught came from the woke historians. And then Sweet did as what has disappointed many of us in these last couple of years of cancellation and wokeness, wrote a very
groveling. You're going to say groveling?
I am going to say groveling. You know, like
obsequious, toadyish.
Drew Bledsoean. I'm so sorry. Oh, I didn't understand. You know, here's another institution of an academic profession. It's not, you know, necessarily academic, but, you know, American Historical Association. We see these kind of things in medical associations, trade associations, just another one where wokeness seems to rule in the face of weakness. Victor, I'm sure there's a classical association that has kind of mirrors this lunacy. Any thoughts about this before we get on to
questions? Yeah, just two or three general ones. One is when you're confronted with a totalitarian ideology, and that's what wokeism is. It's an ideology that says all inequality, past, present, future, is defined only by oppression and not by other extraneous factors. So if you have more money than I do, Jack, it's not because you work harder, you're smarter. It's because I'm oppressed by some cosmic force. Anyway, so that's an ideology. And when you have Salem Witch interrogators, or you have the McCarthyites in the 1950, I have a name of 209 suspect, you know, that not that there weren't, but when you or you have the Soviet show, you can't apologize if you're in the right. You just can't do it. And the more you apologize, the more they get empowered. So Mr. Professor Dr. Sweet did apologize, and he did so, as you said, in toadyish fashion, and it just incited them more. We knew it. We saw. See, even he admits it. So he should have been defiant and said, look, if you don't want me as the head of the American Historical Association, then damn it, have a recall election. See how far you get. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. I'm willing to take the consequences, but I have nothing to apologize for. I'm calling. And what was he calling for? He was worried that we, in an overly injudicious manner, are using the values of the present to use history or the study of the past for contemporary political purposes. And by that, he means that if some pioneer in a wagon on his way to California wrote a diary and he used an inappropriate term, then we condemn the entire westward truck because it was plagued by racism, sexism, homophobia, transgender, whatever. But we use the values of an affluent, leisured society that has the benefit, supposedly, of a moral progression of over a century. That's what he was objecting to. So he wasn't trying to excuse slavery or any of this. He was just saying, if you put yourself into the mindset of the people at the time and the physical conditions under which they lived, remember, in most pre-industrial societies, a woman might have to be pregnant 20 times in her lifetime, between 15 and 35. And then out of those 20 pregnancies, maybe 15 would actually not be miscarriages. And out of the 15, maybe 10 would come to full term, and maybe out of the 10 that came to full term, maybe 8 would be successful. They wouldn't be breached or something. And then out of the 8, maybe 5 would live past the age of 3. and childhood diseases. So that's what you're looking at. And then if you look at the man, the husband, he was a farmer. 95% in the time of the founding were farmers. And his life was basically getting up at dawn and going to bed at dusk, working out in the fields to live one more day. And now you're going to go back and say, well, these people were oblivious to issues of transgenderism, or they had certain, you know, pre-modern ideas about ethnicity or diversity, and that's what he was trying to suggest. And you know, the irony, Jack, is that I think he's the same Professor Sweet that is a man of the left. I mean, he writes about slavery and how Africans were forcibly transported to the Caribbean and in North and South America. And he's at a very liberal history department, traditionally very, very left-wing at the University of Wisconsin. So what we're watching is a man of the left whose entire research interest have been on woke issues, the exploitation of Black people as slaves in the New World, and thereby was selected as the president of the American Historical Association, just writes a wishy-washy, milk-toasty, sober and judicious, mild little squeak about maybe we shouldn't go too far and use history as melodrama rather than tragedy. And they just nuked him and he fell on his sword. Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean it. I had no idea how my horrible views hurt other people.
Said, sounds sorry. Reminiscent of the purge trials of the of the 1930s.
He should go watch. He really should go watch. We have some of those tapes of the show trials that Beria, and that was the beginning of the Beria era. He should go watch them. He should go watch some of the Nazi trials when they brought most of the anti-Nazis that were tried were defiant. But some of them weren't. He should go listen to those. He should read accounts of the Salem witch trials. He should look at the Inquisition and see what people said under those periods. And it doesn't do any good is what I'm trying to say. All it can do is protect his family. So if he thinks, well, I have a son that wants to be a professor, and this is why it won't work. It will not work. They're going to be in power. They're going to say, well, we took down the head of the AHA. Let's go to the next person. Right. Let's take down the the chairman of the Harvard History Department. And then they brought in the 1619 Project, and that's like an old dog bone. It gets buried and dug up and then chewed again. And usually when it's completely discredited, they usually say, well, it was only white men that discredited it, or, you know, you constructed expertise in your field, or I never said it was history. Nicole Hannah Jones. It was only journalism. It was intended to be provocative. No, it was intended to be pseudo history, so you could become very wealthy and famous, and the New York Times could run it. We could inject it into all the school districts' curriculum. So that was that. It's depressing. It's mirrored image in every single learned society, and it dovetails with the news today that Joe Biden is forgiving another round of hundreds of millions of dollars for student loans without any preconditions. And you say to yourself, do you wonder why there are 4 million less students than there were just 8 years ago? Maybe it's because this filters down to parents and they say, oh my God, do I want to borrow $250,000 to put my kid into that place?
Right.
And the answer increasingly for half the country, nope. Not this pig, non hic porcus. I'm not doing that.
Well, I was, as a parent, an idiot. All my kids went to state school. I paid the bill. I should have sent
You weren't an idiot in the sense that until very recently, the lifetime earnings over a lifetime of work, 30 years, was higher with a bachelor's. It is still, but not as much as it was, and it has to calibrate the interest on the student loan if they weren't paid off.
Well, that's
I did the same
there was
thing.
I took no loans out, and mimicking the popular complaint and a right complaint, like why the hell should I or anyone else be paying these debts off? I mean, where's the money come from? Fantasyland?
I know. I did the exact same thing. I was in my mid-40s and I said to myself, one, two, three, here is going to be the tuition, and they're going to overlap, but it's going to be a 9-year period, and I'm going to need about, you know, for each one, some, I think 1 year there were, well, there were never three at the same, yeah, there were, 1 year there were three at the same time.
Wow.
And I said to myself, I'm going to have to come up with, I think it was $500,000. And I said to myself, okay, I'm going to borrow this much, and then I'm going to go out on the road and do what it takes, speaking.
Right.
And I flew all over the United States. My daughter was very ecstatic. She would have a little email, and I would put money in her account, and then she would pay off her student loan. And she was almost there. Another 10,000, we're done. So it was, that's what people do. And now we're told that if you did that, you're a sucker and a fool.
A sucker, right. Yeah.
And if you're out there right now and you're driving down 101 as a long haul trucker, or you're on top of a roof right now in Fresno and it's going to be 105 today and you didn't go to college, well, you're paying for it. You're paying so that the psych major that owes $250,000 in his part-time teaching 6 units, that you're going to help him forgive that loan. And if you were another person, you're married and you have 3 children, and you were going to get a second car for your wife, and you decided instead that you wanted to do the patriotic thing and pay off your student loans at $500 a month. Sorry, we're not going to give you anything. You were an idiot, because in Joe Biden's America, being thrifty and respecting your name and trying to pay off what you owe is the lot of a sucker.
Yeah. Well, you're speaking of one, Victor. Hey,
I'm speaking as one.
Well, let's call this, rename this podcast, The Suckers. So,
yes.
Hey, we'll try and get in 2 questions here, Victor.
Okay.
And one will be about aviation policy. It may have a short answer. Of course, you're someone who's been tormented by aviation over the last few years. And the other question will be about civil war, not the civil war, but civil war. And we'll get to the aviation question right after these important messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and 3-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show, the Victor's Way teaching episode, 1 of 6 that we are recording in advance of Victor's 2-week term teaching up at Hillsdale College. This particular episode should be airing on Tuesday, August 30th. So, Victor, this is the only person who submitted a question that requested anonymity. And it's a little long. It has to do with 5G and things like that. And one of your favorite people. No, not Anthony Fauci, but Mayor Pete. So here's what Anonymous wrote. My question, show and tell item, is about aviation. I'm a Boeing 747 freighter captain and regular visitor to the United States, a country that I love and have long admired since childhood. The recent rollout of 5G radio towers has had and is increasing to have a massive and as yet unrealized impact on radio altimeters, and this is called RADALT, widely used by aircraft the world over. This is acute in the United States in particular, because the radio spectrum used by U.S. 5G operators is much closer in frequency to the C-band RADALT bandwidth. That power output is significantly higher, and the transmitters are not angled groundwards, as is required in Europe and elsewhere. My question is why Mayor Pete, as Secretary of State for Transport, that's what he calls it, we'll just call him Secretary of Transportation, has seen fit to sign off on this fiasco with no accountability. Why has it not been had broader exposure in the public arena? And why are the American people seemingly content to wait for the inevitable hull loss due to 5G interference before their sense of shock and outrage is unleashed? I fear it was ever thus. I've been flying airplanes for 42 years, and I've seen my beloved industry advance leaps and bounds in terms of flight safety and evolution of culture across the world to be reflective of best practices, often, sadly, in response to accidents with large body counts. In historic terms, this 5G C-band radio interference is, on any reasonable analysis, a massive leap into the dark ages. Put differently, it is a clear and present threat to flight safety. Something ought to be done. Why is a crash necessary to advance flight safety? Victor, there's a lot of learning in there.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of expertise that I don't have. All I can say is that I've heard of this before, and I've talked to people about it, and it seems to be that the airline industry is worried because in these major hubs, this 5G new technology interferes with their altimeters. And what's happened now is that I think the industry is trying to create filters or something like that to filter out and to make them immune from 5G. And in the process of developing that technology, supposedly, I think they call it mitigation, the phone companies are trying to say, you know, we're going to hold back a little bit, or we're going to restrict service a little bit till you guys come up. And that was a FAA compromise. But I will say one thing. It seems to me that any time there is a problem in particular industries, especially things like cell phones or social media or the internet, the people that are worried about it are outgunned. So I know it's a multi-billion, billion-dollar industry, the airline industry, but they're up against cell phone industry. And they're up against 5G, and they don't have a chance. And the same thing is true of social media. You're not going to be able to touch those people because they have $6 trillion in market capitalization. They can do whatever they want. It's kind of like 1880, you know, the Southern Pacific or the Northern Pacific Railroads or the Union Pacific. I grew up with stories from my grandfather, you know, who said, well, you know, when we came, they sold us this land. They sold to my grandmother for $4 an acre. And we had to improve it. And we did. And then they came in and they wanted to know whether we could, 20 years later, in 1895, they tried to take it back. And we proved it was theirs. And they went over there at Muscle Slough, 8 miles away. They fought it out with the railroad. They did. And that's the basis of Frank Norris's great novel, The Octopus. So I think we're in that situation again where there's enormous amounts of money. And if Pete Buttigieg is going to be the adjudicator and says, on the one hand, I'm the FAA and this is the airline industry and this is the 5G band signal lobby and here are the airline companies and I'm going to find a compromise that keeps everybody safe until either the 5G has the technology that it won't interfere or the airlines have filters that will block it for their own gauges. He's not the person to do it. I don't mean that just because he's a sop, a fool, sanctimonious, self-righteous, and inert, but I mean that his record, all you have to do is go down, fly over the port of Los Angeles, and it is a mess. Whether you calibrate that mess by containers strewn all over the port, or ships out to the horizon backed up, or supply delays, or you want to fly like I have to do Saturday, but the last two or three times I've flown, if I want to go to Reno, it's what, 250 miles from Fresno? It's an 18-hour Homeric Odyssey to get there. I met cyclopses and sirens on the way, believe me, in airports. And on the way back, I thought I was between a rock and a whirlpool.
Right.
So my point is that the rock of sirens, or excuse me,
the sirens, snakes, yeah.
Snakes Scylla. And my point is that he's not the man for the job. He wasn't appointed to do the job. He has no expertise for the job. He was appointed because he ran for president and no one wanted to vote for him. And he was smug, as I said, self-righteous, sanctimonious. And they thought they'd put him in there. And he thinks he has future political possibilities and it would be better to keep him close than outside. And then they would reward him for endorsing Biden. Remember, this all goes back to the South Carolina primary when Clyburn took a inert. He was like a Joe Biden was like a bicycle tire with seven holes in it that had deflated. And he just went out and got a pump and pumped him up. And then Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, they all put little patches on. Right. And they said, we quit. And then they turned around to him and they said, OK, we put a patch on you, you old tire. Now you're viable again, but we're going to ride you through the election. And here's the deal. I want to be a cabinet member. And then Bernie said, I want a socialist agenda. And Elizabeth Warren said, I want a real a lot of left-wing appointees. And that's how it worked. Okay. That wasn't a very good answer, but that's all I can do.
That's fine. We may have time for also a personal question. And there are a lot of personal questions that have been submitted. It's about your musical tastes.
Music I have tastes, no but, musical talent, though.
Well, it's taste, but let's yes. hold that off on that and let's get to the Civil War question. This is from Tom, and this is addressed former Hansen, Mr. Hansen, Professor Hansen, great American citizen Hansen. I write this question while I'm listening to your podcast, The China Connection. I'm very much enjoy listening, reading, and watching you discuss what is happening around the world and in the United States of America. I personally am not concerned about China or Russia. Both countries are very secular religiously, and I think blowing up the world is not as probable as a lot of talking heads believe. Both countries also have incredible problems within their borders, economically, population, and technically wise. So my question is concerning the United States of America. I very clearly see this country sprinting down the road to a civil war. Comparisons to the 1850s are pretty clear. Will the civil war be with states? No, but it would be down the political divide. Most Democrats are located within cities, so it would be a matter of encircling the cities and starving them out, tactically speaking. I don't want that. 800,000 to a million people died in the first Civil War, maybe more given infections, starvations, etc. The only way I can see to prevent this Civil War is with the media, but that's controlled 90 to 10% liberal to conservative. How can we clean up the media? Or is it a case of the genie is already out of the bottle? And this is Tom. And if I may say before you take this on, I don't think Tom is back at headquarters plotting the strategy for a war. But, you know, it is a question on a lot of people's minds. Like, we are getting to the brink of something. And does that brink entail violence? I mean, we have violence in the streets now, but like, what do we do? Just sit here and
well, remember one thing, dear reader and Jack and everybody listening, this whole Civil War porn myth, that was not from the right. That was from the left. I know that readers worry about it, but what do I mean by that? And I wrote a column called Civil War Porn and then Insurrectionary Porn. So ask yourself, if you think a civil war is on the horizon, and it may be, but who is prompting it? Who wants to make revolutionary changes and ram them through? Well, who wanted to end a 233-year-old filibuster? Who wanted a 180-year-old filibuster? Who wanted to trash a 233-year-old electoral college? Who wanted to get rid of the 150-year-old nine-person Supreme Court judges? Who wants to get rid of a constitutional prerogative for the states to be the primary adjudicators of voting laws, who wanted to get rid of 60 years of 50 states to get in four more senators? It was the left. Who wants to do really revolutionary things in the street? Who wants to, for example, swarm the homes of Supreme Court justices and not enforce the law that it's a felony to do that? Who wants to dog people as they eat dinner, as they rushed after Justice Kavanaugh, or as Maxine Waters advised? She was only retreading, believe it, you know, Barack Obama's 2008 call to get in their faces when he was in Philadelphia. Get in their faces, he said. And so who tears up the State of the Union? Who denies minority members of the House, the minority party members, that they can't be on a committee? These are revolutionary acts. They're all done by the left, number one. Number two, so they're going to say, well, how about January 6th? Well, let's look at it. It was one day, and it was a buffoonish riot, and there's people still rotting in jail. And nobody wants to be transparent about it. This January 6th has no people on that committee from the opposite party unless they have no political future and they voted to impeach Donald Trump. And there's not going to be any FBI people called in and say, would you please give us the number of FBI informants at the event? Tell us what their role was and what their reports entail. And then we have nobody who said, who said that Officer Sicknick was murdered by a MAGA person? And how did that false narrative become entrenched? And what are all the private documents between the White House, Capitol Police, Nancy Pelosi, and the mayor of Washington that might explain why there wasn't enough security, A, and why you put more troops in to Washington after the threat was over with Bob Weier since Jubal Early's raid on Washington in 1864? These are questions. And then let's compare that to the 120 days, 2 billion, 35 to 40 dead, 1,000 to 1,500 officers maimed, injured, attacked severely, and $2 billion of property. That it was a revolutionary act. That was dreamed up by Antifa and BLM. And if you go back and look at the stories and the braggadocio, not from me, but from them, they planned most of that on social media, including the May 31st assault on the White House grounds, where they got close enough to breaking through that Donald Trump fled to an underground bunker, and the New York Times giggled, oh, Trump retreats. So the point I'm making is that if you actually look at the record, they're the one pushing the envelope. And then if you look at the literary record, such as it is, go read The New Republic, good leftist venue now, or The Nation, socialist communist venue. And what do you find? Blue Exit and Time to Disengage. And they are systematic calls that blue states are much smarter. They have all the universities, they have all the investment money, they have all the tech. They're the blessed people that look out on either Europe or Asia, and they should quit. They should get out. Or they are triumphalist. It's only a matter of time before we win over America because we control, the schools, the universities, professional sports, entertainment, Wall Street, investment, high tech, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all coming from the left. And it's not coming from somebody who wrote that note. He's worried that it's coming, but he's not advocating it. So what does the left do then, Jack? They do what they always do. When they plant this Civil War insurrectionary bug, they project. They don't want to be part of us, America. They hate the Constitution. They feel they're smarter and better and wealthier, but they don't want to say that they're neo-Confederates. Although, you know what's funny? Just as an aside, they are neo-Confederates. They have adopted nullification, just like South Carolina. 550 jurisdictions are sanctuary cities where federal law does not imply. It's sort of like a blue state mayor says, open borders today, open borders yesterday, open borders today, open borders tomorrow, in good George Wallace fashion. And they are the ones, they don't have big cotton, but they have big tech, where they have these multi-trillion dollar industries that kind of warp the local economy, that run things as they do in California. Well, California is run by big tech just the way that the old South was run by big cotton. That's who they are, and they project onto us that we're these gap-toothed, stinky insurrectionaries that should rot in hell in solitary confinement and be abused by our jailers as punishment for being insurrection. That's how they work. Right. What is really insurrectionary and revolutionary is going after a president of the United States and having a warrant that gives you free license to rifle through all of his documents and then not explaining why or what you did, and then blasting anybody as unfair or illiberal for criticizing you and your agency while you're systematically leaking lies out to an obsequious press. That's what Merrick Garland does. That's a revolutionary act. And if you think Donald Trump was a revolutionary, you should ask yourself, who was his lowest learner in the IRS who tried to deny nonprofit status before an election to liberal groups? Who was his James Comey FBI director? Who is his Christopher Wray? Did he raid? Why didn't he raid Joe Biden? Why didn't he raid Barack Obama's home? He had missing documents.
Well, they had a laptop, which they knew was had.
Yeah. Why didn't he? Did Donald Trump said, you know what? Eric Holder, he said he was a wingman. He shouldn't have done that. He was DOJ. He didn't follow a congressional subpoena. He just snubbed his nose. Go find him and get him on the street and put leg irons on him, just like he did Peter Navarro. He didn't go after John Podesta that was under a cloud and have a SWAT team arrest him.
Right.
He didn't do that. He didn't round up a bunch of generals and say, you know what, Joe Biden is a fascist, Mussolini, all of that stuff. So for all their talk about Trump, he didn't pack the court. He didn't say, we're in control now. We're going to end the filibuster. He didn't do anything the left is doing. Not that he might not have wanted to, but he didn't. He was the most autopsy probed, dissected, examined, re-examined president in history. And they are their insurrectionists. Remember that. They are the rebellious ones. They are the ones that are pushing to radically change, or to use Barack Obama's words, we're only, 8 days before we can fundamentally transform the United States.
Yeah. Okay, Victor, we are almost out of time. But we're going to get to your musical preferences question or answer to a question right after these important messages.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. This particular podcast, the Victor's Teaching at Hillsdale podcast, one of six we're doing, will be airing on August 30th. Yeah, Victor, we have a very brief question from Gary. Does VDH enjoy music? Now, what type does he favor? Victor, are you? I don't know. I know. I never heard you whistling a tune or anything. What are your proclivities here?
I always listen to music. I do it all the time. And it's eclectic.
Okay.
So I think if I'm just doing this by memory, but if I have Pavarotti, Rigoletto, I listen, one of my favorite, there a lot of them are 60s groups, so people wouldn't remember The Weight by the Band. I play that all the time. I like Bob Dylan, especially Knocking on Heaven's Door. I had that as my answering for my phone. He's Not Dark Yet. I remember that song. I play it all the time. You know what? I like leftist, nutty, crazy Joan Baez. She had that one early album where she really, and people don't give her credit, she made famous Bob Dylan.
Right.
She took his brilliant compositions and then she recalibrated them to make them mellifluous. So if you know, those songs like You Ain't Going Nowhere or I Pity the Poor Immigrant or One Too Many Mornings, Restless Farewell, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
I even play... Peter, Paul, and Mary, 500 Miles. I love that song.
Yeah.
I like that song. I'm trying to remember who wrote it. I'm trying to find it right now. You hear that?
I hear. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. By the way,
Goodbye.
Oh, okay.
I just Botticelli. Is that his name? Botticelli.
Botticelli. Who's
yeah, I just
blind,
looked it up on
the blind
tenor.
Yeah.
I just looked it up on the internet as we were talking because I couldn't remember it. But that was a song I like. That's kind of a popular one. I'm still going, so I'm doing by. You know what? You know that I like that one from Puccini, Gianni Sacchi. You know, O Mia Baba. What was the name of that one? It was a famous.
Not La Donna Mobile.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, really? Oh,
and then there was a weird group that was kind of a gay four. What were they called? The Four Non Blondes. What's Up? Revolution. That was. I used to listen to that one. And my favorites. I'm going crazy now. And
that's all right. Let's end it with this one. Yeah.
I like Mark Knopfler, especially things that one album he did with Emily Harris on the Road Running.
I don't know of it.
You don't know
Mark
that?
Knopfler? No, yeah. I'm
Mark Knopfler. I think it's Knopfler? I think it's K-N-O-P F-L-E-R. Emily, If This Is Goodbye and On the Road Running. And I was thinking of Joan Baez, that Place Here, De Amor, that old medieval song that she plays. That was a great song. I had a daughter who passed away, and I always play this song in honor of her when I'm driving, and that was on the Colorado Trail. That it's a very sad song about losing somebody, and I play that all the time when I'm driving. There's a lot of people
who sings that, Victor?
It's kind of an old Western ballad.
It's like the Sons of the Pioneers.
Yes, they play it. The Colorado Trail, and it's. It's really a sad song, but it's about a young girl who passes away. And it's, I always have an array too, because, I drive a lot to work.
Right,
so I play, I don't know if I should say this, but I play the Magnificent Seven.
Theme song?
Yes. And I
that's the Marlboro country. That's the Marlboro cigarette theme song.
Exactly. Right? And I play Tex Ritter, High Noon.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden I get in the mood and I play Left Wing Commie Jackson Brown, The Pretender. And my kids drag me to every concert that he comes. I have a good friend, Clint Black. I don't know if you, and he's a wonderful person and he's a wonderful musician.
Yeah. He's your buddy.
Killing Time is killing me.
This Killing Time is killing me. Yeah.
So I talk to Clint as much as I can every couple of weeks, but he's been a wonderful friend over the years.
Oh, terrific.
And show you what kind of guy he is. He was coming to Fresno. And there was a very wonderful student of my wife who has a physical disability. You wouldn't know it by her enthusiasm and eagerness for life. And I just wrote him a note. And the next thing I know, he said, here are the tickets. We want you to, and so we went to the concert last December and he invited her back, front row seats, back before, after the show, pictures with Clint, toured his bus. You could not have, and we parked right next to it. And he was the most considerate, compassionate person you could imagine. He's just a wonderful guy. And I try to listen to almost everything. And for years, I've listened to him live. And there's another song, though. I don't know if you ever saw that. There was a movie with Russell Crowe. And he was about his kid. What was it? The Diviner or the Water Diviner. And it was a great movie. It was underappreciated. But Love Was My Alibi. That was a great song by a guy named Fogelmark.
Okay.
And you can't play anymore The Night That Drove Dixie Down, can you?
That song is
by the band.
One of the great
Yeah, Joan Baez of all people made it famous.
Right.
They wrote it. It's a great thing.
Yeah.
And I like 60s things, some of those weird songs from the 60s, like remember Procol Harum, Whiter Shade of Pale?
Oh yeah. Did you like the Monkees also?
kind of, but I played that one all the time. Wow. And then my children who are 40 and 38 give me I try to tell them what to play and they try to tell me, but they're getting older now, so they're not, but I used to like Neil Young, so I play albums, you know,
right.
Cowgirl in the Sand, Heart of Gold.
That's a great album.
I got kind of, yeah, it's great. I kind of got over that. That Colorado Trail was a guy who died too early. I used to play all of his songs, Cisco Houston, and he was a great singer. And then there's certain songs that are not based that I just like, and they're not based on my, you know, my like of the person's entire work.
Right.
You know, just particular. Oh, you know what I was going to say before I do that? I love my mom. When I was a little kid, I was 5 or 6, and I have a twin brother.
Right.
And I have an older brother, and my mom was kind of on a farm in an 800 square foot home, and she kind of got depressed. She had gone to Stanford Law School, and she went home. She kind of gave up everything and came back. And my dad was a teacher and farmer, but she wanted us to appreciate music. So she would play Rodgers and Hammerstein's music.
Right.
And we had to dance with her.
Oh, my.
And so we had, you remember, Some Enchanted.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Bally High, wonderful guy. Wash that guy out of my hair.
South Pacific is one of the great musicals.
Younger than Springtime. And anyway, I knew those. So I play that in honor of my mother. And then there was a weird movie, an Australian movie about a deal with... trying to remember it, but it was Nick Cave, that Australian, the writer song. I play that a lot. You know, I know that Neil Simone was a very problematic singer, but who knows where the time goes. She did a version that Judy Collins did. That was also the theme song of a very good movie.
I think it was
Javier Bardem. It was about the revolution in The Shining Path, and somebody... I always like You're So Cool, that, you know that true romance movie by Tarantino. He wrote the screenplay.
I think
Ridley Scott's brother did it. And You're So Cool, I play that all the time. I'm getting into this.
I listen to a lot of music.
I have Ray, when I'm coming back sometimes.
Ray Charles?
Ray Orbison.
Oh, okay. All right.
Pretty Woman, You Got It. I love that song, You Got It. And then Crying, Love Hurts. I couldn't figure out. Maybe somebody listens. This is a guy who's a very conservative guy. He had a big comeback.
Roy Orbison.
Orbison. You know, he's kind of pure white with those sunglasses.
Yeah, Roy. Yeah, actually.
Yeah,
he's a unique voice.
He does. And he was wonderful. And he writes the same song theme.
Yeah,
whether it's Falling in Love or Dream Baby or Blue Bayou or Life Fades Away, whatever they are, they're all about a guy like him who loves a woman who doesn't like him.
Right.
And it's kind of strange. I like that song. My daughter, Susanna, used to call me, and she'd always play it to get me in a good mood. Not that I'd ever know anything about them. It was the Cranberries. Remember them? They had a song called Dreams, and then Ordinary Day, Dolores O'Riordan, I think her name was. She died tragically. I'm getting back into my high school favorite. He was one of the great tragedies of music, I think, modern music, when Otis Redding died. He was just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And he died in an unfortunate air accident right when he was at his, he wasn't even at his peak. But, you know, his rendition of My Girl.
Yeah.
Or Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, Try a Little Tenderness, or what was that song? Fa, fa, fa. And I've Been Loving You Too Long. So I better stop. But I like music, and I play all the time. And
This Victor, a column by you on what I'm listening to, I think would prove very popular.
You know what I also listen to? I said cowboy. music tracks. So
I love
the Max Steiner, the one that he did for The Searchers. That John Wayne movie. That is really good. I think the Sons of the Pioneers, you know,
they were in that, right?
Yeah. I'm not saying that I don't know 80s, you know, like The Journey, Faithfully, or Blondie, Call Me. I used to listen to I don't want to get into the people that are very, very political that I used to listen to, but I can't listen to them.
Yeah, it's like Joni Mitchell, who's just terrific, but it makes me like not want to.
Some of the people had the best voices were the Righteous Brothers. Remember the Unchained Melody and all of those. They were just Van Morrison. Gosh, Tupelo Honey, Brown Eyed Girl. I listened to that all the time.
Wow.
And for my father's memory, he was Ave Maria, Schubert. You know, I play that a lot.
Oh, he did
when I'm driving.
Oh, okay. I sing that at mass.
So. I'm getting kind of exuberant when you ask this, because I associate these songs with moments, not in the present, not in the future, but in the past. And every time I'm thinking of something, I try to bring out, you know, I have a bunch of old cell phones or something. They're on there, and I just plug them in. And I didn't, until I got a new pickup, I didn't have any way. I had, you know, they weren't Bluetooth. You'd have to plug them in, and you could fiddle around. And if you're driving 180 miles and you don't want to listen to the same news story 100 times,
right?
You know, another group I loved was the Kingston Trio.
Yeah,
and I play a lot of their Tom Dooley.
There's a lot of the Mighty Wind, the movie. Folk music of America was really pretty cool, and it's interesting how
I have a lot of those albums. They're folk music of the 60s, and they're the Limelighters and the Lemon Tree by them. I think it was Glenn Yarborough was great, and then the Kingston Trio, John Baez. I try to play all of those.
All right,
Victor, Jerry Maguire, The Eve of Destruction. I play
Green
Going Away, all those songs, The Other Side of the Hill.
Green, going away.
Yeah, so I try to be eclectic. And lately I've been, because I've had a kind of a chronic illness, I've been getting depressed, not depressed in the, you know, the serious, but just I've been attracted to Johnny Cash's last sorts of song before he died. Oh. Remember that weird Hurt album?
Yeah.
He wrote the, I'm trying to find it. I just found it online. Oh,
We've Worn Out His Greatest Hits. It's terrific. Yeah. My son plays, and he does a lot of Johnny Cash.
He does Danny Boy and Streets of Laredo. Streets of Laredo is a great song. It's very sad.
It's terrific. It's
been reworked so many times.
Yeah, it was a theme in the movie, the baseball movie, Bang the Drum Slowly.
I forgot about that. It was. You know, another song I like, and I really liked him, was the Marshall Tucker. Heard it in a Little Left song. Is that what it was? It's a great song. I used to listen to the Marshall Tucker Band a lot when I was younger.
All right, Victor, this conversation could be going on an hour now.
You turned me on.
I'm sorry. I mean, I'm not sorry, because it should have been just a whole podcast on musical interest. So, hey, but Victor, before we go, I do want to read one comment from one of our listeners. And this happens to be a comment, not on Apple Podcasts, but on your website. And it's from R. Ellen. And this has to do with the show you and I recorded recently about crime in America, which has gotten a lot of attention. I think you were just terrific on it. He writes, or R. Ellen, I'm not sure, I guess it's he. I taught adult education in a California maximum security prison for 25 years. Wow. Nearly 100% of my aides and students were either Hispanic or Black. I never met one who thought of himself as a victim of white racism or the system. Often they would comment that the leniency they received in their own homes, neighborhoods, schools, etc., contributed to an attitude of contempt that led to even greater crimes as adults. A routine commentary often went like this, quote, "My sister is an officer in the LAPD, and my brother works for Google. I was the screw-up in my home. I put myself in this place," end quote. Thanks for reading. So thanks to R. Ellen and the others who comment. Many people comment on the podcast on your website. And of course, many, of course, do on Apple Podcasts and rate the show. And we thank them. Thank everyone for listening. And Victor and I have a bunch more podcasts to record. And we're going to get to that. You're going to be listening to them, we hope and pray. And I guess this is where we say thank you very much for listening to the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you very soon.